This Sunday.
Sunday.
In the Infant Dome, Randy Sinister Snyder and his brother Jimmy.
Jimmy is pretty sweet on you.
Take on an erroneous comment made by Randy in a previous episode. So hold on to your little factories, listeners, as Randy and his brother take on the topic of change as an ex-Mormon.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Infants on Thrones. This is Randy. Recently, we had a podcast. It's entitled Bob's Superlative Disorder, in which we talked about how much do we change when we leave the church? Does our personality change? And I gave a very poor example of four genetically identical people and their personalities, which was fallacious and was not supported by any data.
We are basically the same person. We
just do different things, think different things, believe different things, see the world in a different way, but you're still the same person.
Yeah, you put genetically identical people, put them in four different situations. Yeah, they're going to be different because of all the experiences they've had and the knowledge that they've gained. But they're still genetically the same person. And it's not like you're going to have some – and I think what Keith was getting at, you're not going to have some rapid change in your behavior. Our personalities remain intact through this process. But it's just how we view the world and how we're viewed by other people change.
But what is our personality if not – how what we're interested in talking about and how we view the world, right?
I mean, see, that's not your personality. That's what you. Yeah, that's what your interests are.
That's fair.
Okay.
And so I wanted to really flesh this topic out, and I've called on my older brother Jimmy. He's going to join me, and we're going to discuss this issue of personality change and how we're viewed through the apostate lens.
Okay.
So our personalities are heavily influenced by our experiences when our brain is forming its hard connections. That's why for all of us, that's why with Bob's Mormon cred scale, you can't compare growing up in the Mormon cauldron with converts who are converted in their adulthood. But once your brain is hardwired, in my opinion, our personalities are pretty much set. It's the context of where we see the world that we express our personalities. If you're in a heavily dogmatic religion, your personality will drive your behaviors, but within the bounds of that dogma. But sometimes our personalities conflict with the dogma and will manifest in small ways, like tattoos and facial hair in my case. But once, for whatever reason, we shed the dogma, our personalities are free to express themselves in a much bigger world than the small box dogma allows. But personality traits run deeper than dogma. We all know people with personalities of liars and cheats, and no amount of Sunday lessons could change that. They are in the news right now, and I'm sure all of us have examples of people like this. My own son is a pathological liar. As believers, we were baffled that we couldn't alter this with gospel messages. But my point is that personality, I think, is a red herring in this topic. The real point to focus on is, yes, we all have changed, and that change is a big deal to our believing loved ones and can't be dismissed, even though we know in our metaphorical hearts we haven't had a radical personality makeover since we left the church, but we definitely have changed. And so this is where I wanted to bring in my older brother. For those of you that don't know the backstory, in 1993, my brother Jim graduated from BYU and left to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, to pursue a PhD in political philosophy. He, at that point, had decided that he didn't believe in the church anymore.
Jimmy, oh Jimmy, don't listen to them. How can they say they're your friends if they take you
just through the worst luck you can imagine was outed when he had no intention of being outed. His wife, Heather, was at Lagoon at the same time that my parents were at Lagoon, and she was wearing non-garment approved clothing. And then I got this news just before I went on my mission that my brother had left the church. And Jimmy, can you take it from there?
Well, I mean, what had happened is that my wife was at Lagoon with my daughter, and I was actually just back at school. It was the summer, and they'd been on a vacation, but I had been out for a really short time and had seen my mom, and I could tell that she was looking at me and thinking that, you know, something was a little bit off. She could just, you know, I must have been exuding some sort of odor of non-Mormon and or ex-Mormon. And but I, you know, I just reassured her. The one thing that people need to know at this point is that she was terminally ill. And, you know, it was a pretty delicate time to be introducing something like that to her. And I went back to school for my exams and all that sort of stuff. And Heather stayed. And by accident, not even knowing my parents were still in town, they ran into each other. And so before you got the news from them, I got a call. And Mom called and was trying to talk to me, but she really couldn't finish any sentences. She broke down. She was just bawling the whole time, and Dad had to take over and just basically mediate between us until she had to leave the room.
So Mom couldn't relate to you in any way.
Well, we, for the longest time, had not, I mean, even when I was solidly in the church, we didn't really relate very closely. I don't think that she had an easy time communicating herself with anyone. And, you know, our personalities were very, very, very different. So basically there was already some sort of difference in just outlook and, you know, disposition and everything like that. But we had the church in common. And it was a huge difference. It wasn't just that we were very different people. Now it's as if I had gone off into some sort of abyss. I'd become incredibly, you know, strange to her. I was unintelligible. There was, you know, I had made a decision that made no sense.
Can you tell me a little bit about actions Mom took to try to reclaim you, namely our Uncle Roger?
Yeah, I mean, she, first of all, one of the things that you do, and she, mind you, she couldn't talk to me, but she talked to Dad a lot. And so I would have conversations with Dad, and it would be this sort of desperate thing that I think most of us who leave the church are familiar with. Hadn't you thought of this? What about that? And of course, if you've left the church but were once in it, you ask those questions of yourself as you, you know, went on. They never, ever asked a question that I hadn't already asked myself, because they were the natural questions to ask. But, you know, she, you know, wasn't getting any satisfaction with Dad in the conversations with me. I was just trying to deflect them for the most part. So Roger, Uncle Roger, our PhD member of the church educational system, who had done a dissertation on Joseph Smith as both a poet and prophet, and so on and so forth. So she got a hold of him.
Not only that, he had risen in the ranks of the church office building. He eventually became the head of intellectual property of the church.
Yes,
and we have some stories where he took our dad through the church archives, and he pointed to some boxes. This is the story Dad told me, that those are the boxes that are off limits. No. So, yeah, if anyone has any, if they think that it's just a myth that the church has a bunch of information that they're keeping in the shadows from the public, it's not a myth. And it's confirmed by our believing dad telling a story of our ultra-believing uncle who rose to the ranks of the church office building.
So we've got a wonderful secondhand story to tell people.
It's still secondhand, yes.
But it's true. I believe it with all my heart.
I believe, yes, with every fiber of my being, I believe it's true. But this is, I just want to give a background of why mom thought that this was like the Hugh Nibley of the family, a heavy hitter that could kind of jolt you to your senses and bring you back. But just tell me how it went, or more about the letter, I guess, from Roger.
Well, really, what the letter did, I wish I'd kept it. I am just so sick to my stomach that I didn't. For some reason, I lost it in the course of one of my moves. But he basically said the most important points was that he kind of figured that, he pulled the barrier testimony thing, and he had gone and served in the Vietnam War, and the sort of conversion story that he told, and it's kind of common with the rest of the family, is that he'd been a very spoiled brat. He had been a high school athlete, and he played college football a little bit, been very popular, and he and his wife were both very good looking, and they'd gotten married young and were kind of spoiled, and then he went to Vietnam and had a life-changing experience and in a paddy, flat on his back in the middle of war. He had just a very deep, undeniable spiritual experience. He had hoped that that would work. But then he did pull something that was kind of an intellectual move. He says, you're a PhD in a philosophy program, and I'm sure you think you're really smart, but, I have a PhD too, and I've thought about this, and I've looked at the evidence, and if you want to debate, I'm up for it. And it was a little bit of a gauntlet. I don't know if it was – it seemed kind of like almost a challenge for a debate, but I didn't ever even really respond because I just felt like it would be really unseemly for us to have a debate, especially when mom was terminally ill. It just seemed like it would be kind of weird and wrong-headed. And so I just called dad and asked him to tell Roger that I wasn't interested in any sort of debate, and then never heard back from him.
Yeah, and one thing you've told me is, like, let's say we engage in this debate and I win, what do I win?
Yeah, I don't want him to lose his testimony. I mean, that would destroy his family's life, his own life. It wouldn't make the world any better. It wouldn't necessarily make me feel better. It'd make me feel kind of crappy for having engaged in the debate in the first place and then having been, like, a bad enough person to really work hard to convince him. It just was kind of just a really unappealing thing anyway. There was nothing to win and everything to lose.
Right. And you fast forward like 20 years and his daughter, Mary, who is very intelligent, very sweet, and somewhat educated, woman, woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't sleep because she was thinking about me. Apparently, news had got to their family that I also had left the church. And she sent me this handwritten, like, who in 2011 writes handwritten letters? I don't know. I guess she does. But she wrote me a handwritten letter, and it was with all the best intentions. But she basically told the story of her husband's cousin who had left the church and had engaged in all manner of debauchery, legal, illegal, everything, and eventually found himself in prison, miserable. He was, from her description, he would sound like a really horrible person, and then eventually he died in prison, and she had recently gone to his funeral. And, she said, no matter what you do, I will always accept you. But it was like she was comparing me to this horrible person just because I'd left the church. And so the reaction that I had was like, fuck you. I'm the same person. It's not like I had a personality makeover when I left or stopped believing in the metaphysics of Mormonism or the the narrative of Mormonism. And that's kind of what we are looking to talk about now, because like mom could not be in the same room with you without crying. She just didn't understand you. She, like, it was like you were a foreign entity to her. I mean, do you want to talk any more about that?
Well, one of the things that was really interesting about it and sad about it was her impotence, right? There was nothing she could do. And of course, she's my mother, and the church is this sort of, you know, system of beliefs that include all these gestures where you just point at that and it just resolves it. You know, the prophet said this, the Book of Mormon said that, but don't you remember the moment when you felt the spirit and all that? And it was almost like you think of situations like when someone leaves a spouse or leaves a longtime girlfriend or boyfriend and says they don't love you anymore. And they start like pulling all the things like, do you remember the time that this, or, you know, there was that incredibly intense experience we had together. Doesn't that mean anything to you? And you just don't get moved by it, right? And so right. It was this strange lack of power that she had that must have been crazy making. And all of my responses didn't make sense to her. You know, it's as if I were, you know, and so she would find it really, really, really hard to talk. Her voice would get wavery. And, as we've talked about this before, even her syntax got really stilted. And, you know, that sort of unintelligibility, it would have, you know, it was as if I was walking around, because not much had really changed. I was obviously not on heroin. I could still speak English. I could walk through doors, you know, if I opened them. You know, I could walk out of the room. I carried on conversation still. I made sense. But it's as if I was like deadpan, like taken on a walk, like Charlie Chaplin's tramp walk or something like that, and was walking around. That was the only thing that had changed, and I was acting like it was normal. You know, it was just weird to her.
They come from another world, spawned in the light years of space, unleashed to take over the bodies and souls of the people of our planet.
And so that sort of like impotence and inability to just move to the typical moves must have been just really confusing and really awful.
This whole time I was on my mission, so I wasn't around to see any of this, but tell the story about her last desperate threat.
It wasn't a threat, actually. It was a really desperate gesture, though. What happened, and this was the Christmas time of 1994, and she had found out several months before, and I came to visit. I was like 28 years old at the time, and I'd been in grad school for 4 years, and, you know, it was time to come back, and mom was dying, and it was very, very painful for her. And right after Christmas, it was a sunny day in our family room, and she just cornered me, and she started asking me those questions. Do you not believe that Joseph Smith is a prophet? Do you not believe that God exists? And she, at one point, she just said, how could you? How could, right? And the only thing I can think of is it was like having, because I was just kept on not moving. I was immovable. And it was as if I had just basically, you know, when like someone says, I want a divorce, I don't love you anymore, I don't love our relationship, I'm not attached to it, and I really need to move on, and it's final. And you say, you know, but what about you love me and you want, and just they don't move, and that you just think, I've got to rise up in my glory in some way so they can just see, right? Mm-hmm. And so mom reached to that moment. It was like she realized, I'm dying, so this. And she said, well, Jimmy, I promise you that when I get to the spirit world, I am going to come to you and I am going to haunt you. And you will see that the church is true then. And I was really taken aback and I didn't know what to say. And it just was rolling around in my mind. I remember getting on the plane on my way home and, you know, just thinking about it and thinking about it, and getting picked up by my friend Marcel, who was a fellow grad student. And I told her, and I wanted to just tell her, look, look at what my mom said. Isn't that messed up? That's just messed up. I wanted to someone to like verify that that was an odd thing to have happened to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt this desire to feel angry or to just like say, that's messed up. That's messed up. And I was telling people and they all confirmed that. I think because they really did think it was messed up in certain ways. But, you know, the more I thought about it, I just could not muster up any anger. I just almost felt like it was like I had to think it was angry just to get a grip on it, and I just couldn't. And that's when I just started thinking, well, it just makes sense. What do you do when your back is against the wall and you desperately need someone to see? You grab for the thing that will make them see. And mom just, that's what she thought of. And on top of that, I mean, of course, I didn't believe that she really could haunt me, so there was no grounds for it to be creepy, right? I would have thought it was like some sort of spasm in my brain. I would have been more worried about, you know, my mental health or if I was hallucinating. I wouldn't have thought, oh my God, mom really haunted me. I can't believe she would do that.
And that means the church really is true.
Yeah.
Now I got to go get baptized again.
Yes, and we all, and as you know, and your readers don't know, I had a really bad health scare, and at one point, it was so bad that I hallucinated for about 36 hours. Not once did I see mom, so that was a relief. That was about 2 years ago.
I guess you heard a Nick Cave song or something.
Yes, I had made up Nick Cave songs going through my head. One called Boom Boom had really great lyrics that I can't remember.
Oh, that's a tragedy.
And so it was like a really, you know, alien situation for her that made her very self-conscious and confused and sad.
Well, that brings me to the question at hand. How much did you change? How much do we change? When are our personalities kind of set? But even once our brains are hardwired, you know, obviously our brains go through changes throughout adulthood. But I know you've done a lot of reading. You do a lot of reading anyway, but you've done a lot of reading in this area of personality and psychology. Why don't you speak to that for a moment, for a while?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, one of the things that happens is that when you do philosophy and if you have a strong interest in moral philosophy and political philosophy, you are forced to study psychology at the same time for about 50 years, the findings of cognitive psychology and social psychology have entered into the work that people do in moral philosophy and political philosophy. And one of the key issues is personality. And whether we really do have some sort of stable personality and how that would figure into the way that we talk about how we should be, right? One of the typical ways you talk about who you are and what you should be is, you know, what sort of traits you should try to develop, you know, like what sort of virtues should you try to cultivate and do you have, you know, to be a good person is maybe to exemplify conscientiousness or, you know, integrity or generosity or courage or something like that. But one of the problems in psychology is that a lot of social psychology especially has introduced a perspective that kind of shows that our personalities or those sort of traits don't actually apply across the board in our lives, that we're very situationally sensitive and we act very differently given the situation. They've got jargon for it, like, is it cross-situationally stable, your conscientiousness or something like that? And most of the research suggests it's not very stable. And so the question of whether you have like a stable personality is a difficult one. But a lot of psychologists and most psychologists think that there are some sort of persistent traits that can change in really surprising ways. You know, when you're one way with your family and another way at work and another way at church and another way, well, that's because you have a different dynamic with the family or, you know, we're all shy and introverted in certain circumstances and like not in others. Like I have no problem public speaking and everyone who hears me publicly speak thinks I'm very, very extroverted. And then they see me in other situations, they think I'm shy.
Yeah. That's why I really, really hate the Minnesota personality index, because it's like, are you an extrovert or an introvert? I'm like, it depends.
Yeah. Yeah. The multiphasic personality inventory. Yeah. But they, you know, there are certain sort of inventories that, you know, have some currency in psychology, and there's like these big five personality factors. They're like conscientiousness, agreeableness, emotional stability or instability, sometimes they call it, or used to call it, neuroticism, openness, you know, extroversion. The opposite is, you know, not being open or being introverted or not being conscientious or being emotionally stable, you know. And there is some stability there, but really, you know, that can change in very, very surprising ways given the circumstances. But, you know, the one thing to keep in mind is that there's also, like, identity is not the same thing as personality, right? And, yeah. You know, identity over time can change when your personality pretty much remains stable, and especially if your identity is closely tied to the church or not.
So identity versus personality. I think that's why I felt like this whole debate that we had on a previous podcast about personality was a red herring, because our identity clearly has changed. You know, I now self-identify as a naturalist, a humanist, whereas before I was identified in a very narrow way. You know, I was given narrow prescriptions on not only socially but politically what I should think. And then once those things change, has my personality really changed?
Yeah. I mean, are you more agreeable or less agreeable in general? Are you, you know, are you more rude? Or, you know, well, I mean, one of the things is, you know, are you more emotionally stable or less emotionally stable? Do you tend to, you know, but on the other hand, I mean, think about it. Like, think about how often someone will say, as a marriage ends, you've changed. Really, right?
Yeah.
When really what's happened is you have something that's core to your relationship with all these sort of like even very subtle ways you talk to each other, things that you cry over, you know, things that make you messed up, things that are common jokes, all this sort of stuff that are all part of this whole story about our lives together and our love together. Right? And it's so core to how we relate that when it ends, it seems like the person is a different person, especially when they're no longer responding to those things that you want them to. Right?
They're not responding to the cues that they used to respond to.
Yeah. It's like I no longer think Boyd K. Packer has any authority over me about masturbation. I no longer, you know, bear my testimony at the moment I'm supposed to. I don't believe that gays should be denied their civil rights.
You don't choke up at General Conference. Now you're kind of rolling your eyes.
Yeah. Or I'm not hiding my rolled eyes like I did for many years while I was in the church. You know, but I mean, so there's a whole like world, and it isn't like it would be one thing like if I stopped being a really strong sports fan, and our family sports are huge, and being a USC fan or something like that is really basic. But when I dropped my sports fandom and taking it really as part of a deep part of my identity, no one felt like my personality had changed, you know. But there's no script either for if you leave sports for something else, right? But right. There is a script for what happens to you, like Mary's letter, about what happens to you when you leave. So they can actually project onto this new person that doesn't make any sense, a script.
One of the things that my fellow infants really emphasized was that I mean, this all started with a podcast called Through the Apostate Lens. Keith was our submitter, and they felt he was really dismissive of, you know, the perspective from the believer, how much we've changed. And, you know, because he kept saying, I'm the same person. You know, why do they treat me so differently? This really sucks. It sucks that the church does this, but... So how much of it is on the church and the narrative that they provide, And how should we respond to our believing loved ones?
Yeah, I mean, I myself, it's like, who else is it going to be on? Is it on me? I mean, I'm not the one who set it up so that it's impossible to understand someone who fundamentally disagrees with me on my religion. You know, I just made a choice that, you know, isn't entirely voluntary. I mean, I just never rang true, really. Deep down, I always was skeptical, and I tried to conform myself to it, and eventually I left. But, you know, the fact that I am unintelligible because I no longer believe, the fact that even from their perspective, let's grant that I'm mistaken, it doesn't mean I've changed so much, is that they don't have any way to understand what I've done. I don't, and the only thing that's left for me to do is something I never could do with Mom because she died, is figure out a way to start communicating with her and slowly rebuild a relationship.
Yeah, and that's some that's something I'm struggling with Dad. You know, I was, of the seven kids, I was his Joseph.
How I love my coat of many colors.
And, when you left and when Kimberly left, I was kind of the liaison, the in-between, the believers and non-believers. And when I fell, it was like the ultimate betrayal because they lost that liaison.
Well, and also you were the only one who did it well into adulthood. Both Kimberly and I left basically in our early 20s or late teens. And so.
Yeah. And that would, I don't even like to think about what it'd be like if Mom had been alive for that. But I guess what I'm getting at is how empathetic should we be to their point of view? Because the fellow infants kept saying that we're, you know, Keith and I are just too dismissive. You know, we have changed, and even though those changes may not be personality changes, they're significant changes, and I don't know how to approach it.
Well, I mean, you know, in what sense of empathy? I mean, like, should we do our best to understand their point of view and where they're coming from and give them a break? Sure.
But that's,
you know, let's give them a break as much as we can. But, you know, they've got some obligations to us, too. They should, you know, it's the thing that they're committed to that is the barrier to the relationship, because we're fine with them being Mormons. Right. It's that they're the ones who can't handle our change. And so, you know, what's left to us is to figure out how to try to restore the relationship in spite of this barrier that's put there by the church for ordinary relationships between people who disagree about.
And really the most frustrating thing that I found is that I know exactly what they're thinking and where they're coming from. But I know that they cannot even fathom what it's like to look back through the other direction.
Yeah, you've been on both sides. I mean, you've been on both sides with me, by the way, right? You've seen me from the inside and you've seen me from the outside, and you know what it's like to look from the inside and to look back. And no one within the church has been on both points of view, but everyone who's left has come from inside. And that was what kind of happened where I could understand Mom.
Yeah, and just another little anecdote for what it was like from the other side looking at you. My missionary scriptures in the Book of Mormon, Second Nephi, there's a verse, I'm paraphrasing it, but it says the learned think they are wise, but it is foolishness. But their wisdom is foolishness, and they shall perish. And in the margins I wrote Jim and Heather, you know, you and your wife's name. That this is the epitome of Jimmy. That's what you look like to me through the lens, and why, you know, we had moments, you know, like when we get together with family, like we said before, you and I would connect, but we still had to stay in areas that were kind of neutral, like The Simpsons, our shared sense of humor. But then now I get to see it, you know, I'm on your side and see it, and it is frustrating to know that it's not there's not an equivalency there.
Yeah, I mean, when we would connect in those sort of situations, I, for example, really did know that you had done something like annotate that part of the Book of Mormon. I would have said, you know, it is good to be learned if they hearken unto the counsels of God or something like that, right? But I knew that was part of the story, and you didn't know I knew.
Right.
You know, and so there is a sort of asymmetry there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we have exercise empathy. I mean, it seems like my fellow infants think that I am too dismissive, but, you know, Dad set up these rules for us to engage with each other, and for the most part, I haven't really violated those rules. I play on the in the areas he wants to, he feels comfortable. And, you know, I don't antagonize him, and I don't want to antagonize him. He's such a good person, sweet guy. Why would I want to cause him pain if I don't have to?
Yeah, and there's no you know, neither one of us has ever engaged in really any sort of debate whatsoever. I mean, what's the point? Yeah. You know, what if we won? That would be a disaster. At any rate, I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of ways in which I haven't handled things right, you know, and I probably haven't identified, you know, one-tenth of them. And I do think about that a lot, you know. But I do think that, you know, I do take seriously the idea that it really will require empathy. But I think it's a matter of being realistic to know that there is a fundamental breach that comes from the side of the apostate lens, as you call it. Well, I mean, it isn't a breach that I would have with my daughter if she became evangelical or Mormon or New Agey, you know, intuitive or something like that. If she became a psychic, you know, it wouldn't be a fundamental loss. It wouldn't be a tragedy. It would just be one thing that we don't have in common.
Wow. Yeah. And that's, to me, that's the big difference. Like, you know, if we were raised in a, you know, kind of like a Episcopalian church where it's kind of liberal, belief is nice, and, you know, maybe you could even say important, but it's not vital. And if you know, someone from an Episcopalian family just decided not to go to church anymore, people, the most common reaction would be just to kind of shrug, well, I guess it's not for him. And there wouldn't be like this like total switch in their mind from the scripts that you get in a very all-encompassing, you know, like that Mormonism gets its tentacles in every aspect of your life and how you see everything. And so leaving the Mormon church versus leaving the Episcopalian church is elevated to the, you know, to the status of tragedy, you know, depending on the person that we're talking about, how centrally tied or how closely tied they are to the core story of the church.
Yeah, the core story that makes it so that Mom and Dad and other people like them feel like it's a tragedy is like reiterated. It's told over and over and over again at church. There's so many cautionary tales. I'm sure that I became one in family home evening, you know, and you know, you hear it over the pulpit, you hear it in general conference, and you hear characterizations of what would lead someone to become rebellious. Obedience is the first law of heaven, so on and so forth. The thing is that if you're lucky, you'll have someone in your family, like our sister Karen, right, yeah, who self-identifies as Mormon but isn't really tied to the core. I mean, Karen never was naturally a Mormon, never has been, and she's very distant from the core. And when I left the church, and I'm sure when you left the church, it was hardly, you know, a blip on her screen, you know. But that's because she was so far away from the church. And I have a lot of friends, and I've had students before and colleagues and people I know who have left the church, and it wasn't a big deal for their family, but like, say, Dad's a convert and never really, you know, incorporated the idea that being outside of the church was a major problem. Or Mom's kind of there for the social reasons, and she drinks coffee on the side, you know, things like that, and then lies to the bishop and goes to the temple because she likes how peaceful it is. You know, that's not a core Mormon in the sense that we're talking about.
Right. Yeah, actually, it was not a blip on Karen's radar, because in March of 2010 was my apostasy tour across to out myself one by one with the family. And Karen lives in Laguna Hills, So it was one of my stops. And when I told her, there was like absolutely no reaction in her face. And she's a Temple Recommend holding member, but you know, she's been kind of, like you said, she's wavered back and forth throughout her whole adulthood, but has never had the disposition to be that kind of Mormon. Whereas her sister Kathy is the opposite. She is tied very tightly to the core of the church, and to her it was a tragedy. It was earth-shattering news for her.
Yeah.
And she's my sister, and I want to have a relationship with her. And so that, to me, it, you know, for someone to say that the scripts of the church, the narrative the church provides for people that apostatize, isn't central to this whole discussion. I don't know how that could be.
I think your best hope, if you leave the church, is for your family members not to really be attached to the core story, right? That's your best hope. And, you know, that's something that I really wish more of our siblings had really been like, you know, just marginal or like active, but not tied to that story emotionally.
Right. Yeah. And I have a couple of friends that we were as tight could be when we were both in the church. And, when I left the church, we still remain friends, but I don't know if I'm projecting, but I sense a sadness. You know, one of my closest friends from, you know, we were thick as thieves through dental school, and we also went to the same residency for ortho. And his first reaction was, I'm just so, this is so painful for me because I've always seen you as a defender of the faith. And so now we text each other, and we almost never talk, and we never visit. We have such a similar sense of humor that we will just text back and forth jokes or lines from, you know, Dumb and Dumber or this obscure movie that we both love. It's a cult classic called High Strung. And I recommend anyone listening to YouTube that. The whole movie's on YouTube. We both watched that movie so many times that we basically have it memorized, and so just randomly we will send those texts. But that's kind of where it's retreated, because we, all that time spent together, you know, we really did talk about the church a lot too.
The basic point being that something that would be a very, very natural friendship can actually have a rift, you know, put into it, driven into it by the core Mormon story, where the core Mormon story is the only reason there's not a connection anymore.
I know, and we have so much in common outside of the church. You know, we're both orthodontists. We have all this shared history. I mean, we lived right next to each other for 2 years in Florida in ortho school. And, you know, we have the similar sense of humor, similar passion for sports. There's plenty there. But he's withdrew a little bit.
That's really sad. I feel sorry for you, because I didn't experience that. I left the church early enough that I did not lose one single close adult friendship.
Yeah, you left early, and your leaving was simultaneous with relocating 3,000 miles away. all your adult friends are from grad school on.
Yeah, I spent 15 years with scarcely running into a Mormon even once, you know.
Yeah, you got to go to Disneyland. Tons of Mormons there, and the way to spot them is they're wearing a white t-shirt underneath a white t-shirt.
Oh, I still can spot a Mormon.
You got good Modar?
Well, I once was one, and I once wore that.
There is one last story I definitely want you to tell. We talked about the despair that Mom had when she realized that you weren't, she couldn't do anything to convince you, to touch you, to shake you from, you know, the new position that you were in, as far as how you saw the world. And so we find ourselves in a very superficial relationship with our believing loved ones.
Yeah, well, we can handle disagreement, but they can't. And so what happens is that if we want to be empathetic, empathy requires us to kind of withdraw and not talk about a lot of things that are basic to our identity now, you know?
Yeah, and even political things within the Mormon Church, the culture now, like politics is almost doctrine these days. And you have a father-in-law who's a very liberal Democrat. He's found a very liberal ward that he can function in Orem, Utah, of all places. That's not the norm in the, you know, what I call the, or what people call the Morador, which is which is the Mormon corridor, which is Idaho, Utah, California, and Arizona. Go ahead.
Yeah, in the Morador, what happens, and it's, you know, once you get outside of it, it can loosen up a little bit, is that because it's primarily you're around fellow Mormons who share a lot of cultural traits that are beyond just the church, including political outlooks, that they start confusing like the smallest thing about, you know, the local culture with some feature of the church, you know. Like when I was on my mission, I had a zone leader companion from, you know, Guayaquil, Ecuador, who was a socialist, who had a picture of Ronald Reagan on the top of, underneath the toilet seat saying, come mierda, eat shit. You know, and you know, you get kind of the sense that he didn't grow up in Orem, you know. Right. But that sort of corridor kind of dominates. I remember I came back from my mission, went to BYU. This was 1988, and it was, or 87, and it was the election, and it was Dukakis versus Bush, and I was liking Dukakis, and I had like horrible feelings of guilt about that. You know, I was like, really, this is like, there must be something wrong with me. And it took me about, well, I met my wife, whose father was a former bishop and a professor who was also a Democrat. And I kind of got over that pretty quick, but I was kind of, I felt awful for a while.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what this ends up doing is like, you can't talk politics, you can't talk religion. And so what's left is to talk this is basically how I function with Dad, is I talk sports and I talk family memories, you know.
Yeah.
Neutral family memories. And is this because I've had a radical personality change? You know, am I suddenly not the compassionate person that I was before? Am I suddenly a dishonest person?
No, but you are a very pain-inducing person if you're not superficial. I mean, your very presence in it, and it's, you know, in certain ways, it goes down to almost anything. Just think about all of the things in your life that you might roll your eyes at or laugh at, right? Or laugh with. Your sense of humor.
Anything on Fox News
will often be inappropriate. You'll roll your eyes at something and it makes them uncomfortable, so on and so forth. And so it can actually extend to very, very subtle things, which means neutral things like sports or, you know, family memories are about all that's left, unless you want to cause pain and discomfort. Yeah. And so,
yeah. And it's really hard for me. You know me. When I feel strongly about stuff, like I want to change hearts and minds, and I know it's like silly and naive that I can. In small ways here and there, I attempt it, but it's painful that I can't connect with my dad anymore, like we used to, because of this apostate lens that he has, and this narrative and this worldview that he sees the world through.
Yeah, it's actually very lonely and isolating. I don't think it I think it has to do with the fact that your political beliefs and your beliefs about religion, your beliefs about science and culture and all that sort of stuff are so central to your identity that it becomes very hard for you. I don't think it's because you're evangelical about your beliefs. It's that those are the things you care to talk about. You could handle them disagreeing with you if you could have a good conversation with them, and you would be able to handle them disagreeing with you and not being able to change their minds. It's that you can't talk or think or joke about all of the things that are basic to the basic things that make you laugh, cry, you know, want to go on a rant and all that. You can't even talk about them. And so it's very isolating and lonely within the family. You become isolated. And that's why for 20 years, you know, but until you left the church, I was essentially in this context of my own family alone, you know?
Yeah. That's a important distinction I think to make is when you're dealing with the apostate lens with friends versus when you're dealing with family, because you know you're kind of stuck with family. There's a sense of obligation that the you know whole blood runs thicker than water cliche, and you know you choose your friends based on common interests. But you know when you're in the church, you have lots of friends that your only real commonality is the church, and then once you remove that, then you know there's nothing there, and you both move on. But I think most of us have had friends that endured through that, or at least I don't know if you did because you kind of moved away to the East Coast, right?
Yeah,
at the same time.
I'd want to add one thing. It isn't, in my opinion, at least, it isn't just that you're forced to or obliged to, and you're kind of stuck together. Although that's one part, and I think it's important. That's why you know that you can go home even if you've really been a jerk the rest of to everyone, all of your friends, because they have to take you. Home's where you, but you also long for it. You long for that connection. Even if I never would have made friends with Mom outside of a family context, I wanted to be bonded to my mother. I wanted a link with her. There was a family tie and a family history, and she is the person who took care of me, right? In so many ways. And I am her firstborn son. So it's obligation plus a real profound desire for a connection that doesn't make sense in the context of friendship.
Right. And the apostate lens is really a lot more of a issue when you're dealing with family, because you have this kind of this deep bond of DNA, shared DNA and shared childhood experiences. That's where the scripts that the church writes for what happens if you leave, why you leave, and what happens after you leave. That's where they, you know, it really becomes a little bit more malignant. And, I mean, that's part of the story that we haven't talked about was how you became kind of the pariah in the family. Nobody, you were like an alien, like some other that, you know, obviously some stork brought you in that, you know, you didn't share anyone's DNA. And then come to find out that you and I are very similar. In our sensibilities and our personality makeup. And once I left the church, we run the very strong risk of having a 4-hour conversation on the phone anytime we talk, you know. So you became this this outsider, or you went from this outsider to like, you know, one of my best friends and someone that you know we share a lot of deep connection to, and that is just completely expelled inside the Mormon paradigm, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, I was entirely by myself until you left, and then you came in, and you know, suddenly I did have someone in my family, and it wasn't because I tried to have as much empathy as possible. Right. And I tried to, you know, not get on a high horse or anything like that, you know, even on issues where I think it's really fundamental, like, you know, denying gay civil rights and dad's, you know, activism against gay rights. It wasn't because of that I didn't speak. It's because you know, I just understood that it would be very painful and awful for everyone if we just constantly engaged in things at that level. And I think in terms of the script that they have for us, you would understand better than I, simply because you have 15 years of adulthood looking at me outside the church, from within the church. And I'd be interested to know what it was like, you know?
The funny thing is that whenever we'd get together with family, when I was still a hardcore believer, you and I would start talking about The Simpsons, and then we would just like go off, and it would just be you and me, and everyone would be watching.
And worrying, definitely worrying. There was something emanating from that conversation that was not correlated, you know, it was not correlational, whatever the jargon is now.
Well, and I guess they were right to worry, because eventually I joined your team, but it's really difficult, you know, because Dad recently visited us in Denver. We just moved to Denver, and you know, his wife. Is a very Glenn Beck conservative, and she wants to talk about things I care about, and I'd like to talk about them. I'd like to dispel some of the myths that she believes in. And Dad, the same thing happened to you just a few days after, which, you know, when he visited you in Utah, he gets a pain over his face. You know, anytime, and the same thing happened when we went to our niece's wedding last month. You and I were in a room with Dad, and we started to talk about things we cared about, and Dad's eyes glazed over, and his head, you know, his eyes kind of cast down, and you know, there was like this pain that was going through, and like, we're like, man, I guess we just got to talk about Little League.
Yes, let's talk about Little League, or let's talk about the nephews and nieces, right, and all that. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's not impossible. I, you know, we, for your listeners, we had a wedding to go to where I kind of like made a real, real attempt to engage the entire extended family. Many, many, many of whom, you know, have thought of me for years as the alien. And I did find for the first time some actually new places to engage them about things that I actually did care about. And in a lot of cases, it was talking about, say, our sister has had some health scares, and talking about how she felt like, you know, having that health scare when I myself recently had had one, or, talking about teaching profession. I teach, and our sister Kathy teaches, and I found a lot of common ground there. And it was the most satisfying thing that I've had with the people in our family that are members of the church. And, you know, maybe there's some sort of way in which you and I can try to figure out how to engage the rest of our family more passionately and, you know, more sincerely and less superficially, without talking about things like politics or religion and all that. But it's really hard, because very quickly it shades into something where we're exuding something kind of uncomfortable without even trying to. So,
right. And just for the record, for the wedding, by sheer coincidence, we both wore black slacks and a gray shirt. We look like the Movementarians from the Simpsons episode.
Yes, they were. And it wasn't just the same colors. They were exactly the same cut on the shirts and on the pants. And it was very, very unnerving, even for me and you. It was like,
oh, man, were we trying to stand out? This is the atheist garb right here.
We do have a uniform, and we are dogmatic religionists, as they say. Right. We've finally shown our true colors, right, family.
We just shed the black and white thinking of Mormonism for the black and white thinking of atheism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
But just to wrap up this topic, how much have you changed since you left the church, and in what ways?
Well, I think that I don't think my personality has changed in terms of like those sort of traits that they tend to track over time and the personality people think are, you know, your stable traits, the ones that are the most stable, like conscientiousness or extroversion or whatever, neuroticism or emotional stability, things like that. I think that my sensibility is pretty similar to what it was from the time I was 14 years old. It's just I'd never found a place within the church to express that, and I was always kind of chafing in the context of the church, even on my mission, which I took very seriously. In a lot of ways, I really loved my mission, and I loved the church on my mission, but I was also always a little bit kind of skeptical against my will and, you know, kind of against the authority and all that sort of stuff, and I hated the numbers and the stats and all that sort of stuff. But I really did, you know, come to believe I believed. But there's always something latent that was waiting to kind of get out. And as I read and read when I got home, I took some honors classes and got exposed to things like Dialogue and Sunstone. And I thought, oh, maybe I can accommodate it like this. And I learned that I didn't believe that evolution was wrong. And, oh, I can accommodate that. But, you know, after a while, really, it just wasn't a stable sort of, you know, I couldn't get to an equilibrium within the church, and I was chafing and chafing and chafing and chafing and bitter. And I've told you this many, many times. I was in a seminar on the philosopher Nietzsche, and there's a book with a character named Zarathustra in it who goes to a city that he had started at, and he sees his double called Zarathustra's ape, who's just bitter and, you know, just like bitter about how horrible the city is and how it squelches souls, and he's squinting the whole time he's talking. And I was like, oh my God, that's me in the church. You know, and then Zarathustra says, he just walks on and he realizes that could have been him if he hadn't left the city. And he says, where one can no longer love, there one must pass by. And I kind of came to a resolve that the church did not fit not only just my beliefs. I was starting to believe, and I kind of knew that it wasn't true. It didn't fit my personality or dispositions, and I needed to free myself. And once I left, it just kind of freed me to ask questions directly. Do I believe this and not route it through the church authorities and try to make it consistent, not try to figure out how to think that, you know, Boyd K. Packer's an apostle and think that he's wrong on almost everything he says, not think about how I'm going to tell my daughter that she's equal and then have her get the opposite, you know, message at church and like tell her that they're wrong, even though I believe in the church, all of that sort of stuff just went away. And it was like, now I was free to kind of come into my own, and it wasn't very different. It was just less constrained. It wasn't chafing. It was free and easy and awesome and interesting and an exploration that, you know, suited me.
And you were suddenly authentic, and that's,
yeah,
that's,
and
that's,
it came into who I'd always been.
Right. And that's the first time I heard anyone say that to me was when I was really distraught, and I called John DeLynn one time, and he was the first one to tell me, well, you're finally authentic. And I was like, holy shit, yeah. Because you, in the many times that we hung out before I left the church, you always sensed there was something inside me that was liberal. Like, you once shook me up, saying, you fit the classical definition of liberal. And I, you know, I voted for Bush like that year. And, and so, you know, really my personality traits were there. They were just constrained within this, this dogmatic religion. And then once I freed myself, like my personality traits just ran wild and I became,
yeah, I mean, what happened was that it was very clear that you started to flourish as someone who wasn't in conflict with everything that you were supposed to be doing.
Right. I was finally comfortable in my skin.
Yeah, and it was unbelievable how quickly you took to it, you know. And I never would have predicted 3 years before that there was even a chance you'd leave the church. I just knew that your disposition wasn't very compatible with it. But I thought that your conviction and your sense of duty to it would keep you in. you know?
Yeah, so you thought the personality traits of, you know, being loyal and responsible would keep me in the church.
Well, plus the church actually is very effective in setting up ways that make it hard to question, you know. You know, doubts can come from, very persuasive doubts can come from an angel of light who's really Satan in disguise, right? There's all these beliefs that protect the rest of the beliefs. And, you know, like, don't question, don't look, don't explore. Anti-Mormons say this. All that sort of stuff made it very hard. And I thought that stuff was going to be strong enough to keep you in for life.
But it didn't. And what was the name of that character? Zarathustra?
Yeah, it's a book called Thus Spake Zarathustra. Nietzsche wrote it.
So just a little side anecdote. Our sister Kathy, she's the one that told me it felt like a death in the family when I left the church. You know, she's a very intelligent, sweet person, and she's been really great since, so I don't want to vilify her too much. But she's basically, you know, the second coming of Mom.
Yeah.
Of any of the kids.
She's an articulate version of Mom. A very articulate version of Mom.
Articulate, and she's also a little more educated than Mom was.
Yeah.
Which is really a shame, because Mom was a 4.0 student at Utah State when she met Dad, but all she cared about was becoming a mother and having his
Yeah.
having as many kids as possible. She had 7. I'm glad she at least went to 5, because that was me. But the phone call, and it wasn't me calling her. She had found out through the grapevine I left the church, and we were in the same ward, for Christ's sake. So she dealt with it right away, called me up. I was on vacation with my family and trying to find the fucking hotel. And she told me that over the last few months, she could see that the spirit had left my countenance.
Yeah,
and so,
because it does.
Because it does. You talked about the chafing and the chafing and the chafing. Like, I would just, like, I couldn't stand going to church anymore, because they would say such stupid things with such arrogant confidence. And, you know, they were wrong. The very last high priest group meeting I went to was an entire lesson about how stupid it would be to be an atheist. And I don't think that was a coincidence. I think the word got out that I don't believe in God. And so, of course, what did my face reflect? My face reflect irritation, anguish.
Yeah.
And
when it wasn't irritated or anguished, it was deadened by boredom and anxiety and all of that. You know, the thing that's ironic about this, or interesting, at least to me, is that for me, you first got the spirit when you left the church. It's like, that's when I first saw you flourishing. That's when I saw you most yourself. I saw a whole different countenance. So maybe the spirit drained out of it, and a new spirit of the devil, or of reason and flourishing and goodness. I don't know what, but there was definitely something really shining in your countenance when you left.
Well, it was a spirit of freedom and authenticity.
Yeah.
And no longer straining under the you know, the, what's the word I'm looking for? The guidelines and the framework.
Yeah, all of the prescriptions.
Right.
But, you know, like, here's one thing that, when I told you that you're really deep down liberal, is that one of the things that you chafed against that you might not think about very much is just certain sorts of rule-based stuff that's kind of part of the culture. I don't know if it's part of the gospel, as if there really is a gospel separate from the culture, but and that is things like the dress code at BYU. You know, and the confusion of beardlessness with, you know, being a condition of spiritual health, you know, swearing, you know, all kinds of things that are like external signs of spiritual well-being in the church that you never really bought. And that, you know, there's room within the church to be someone who disagrees with that stuff, but that was just like the tip of the iceberg. There was a whole suite of traits in you that, you know, that's just one example of, that just felt uncomfortable in the church. And it's really surprising that they ever saw the spirit in you in the first place.
Well, you know, when I was in the in the dating game, I would meet these girls, and I would put on my best face, my future stake president face. But you can only keep that facade up for so long. And so I had, you know, the basic half-life of a relationship when I was a believer, before I got married, was about, the half-life was about 2-3 months. And
then they discovered the lack of spirit beneath the facade.
Right. And the second half was the real me and the breakdown of the relationship until I met Jen, and she was the first person that I dated that wasn't scared off by my rough edges, you know, once I exposed them. And you know, as dumb luck works, at 22 I married her at 19, and it worked out great. You know, I just didn't fit in the Mormon world, and it showed itself in a lot of ways. And eventually, when I left, my true personality came out, and that's really what I kind of wanted to get to was you know, the personality is pretty much formed, wouldn't you say, by at least by about 18. You've had all the formative experiences. Of course, you're going to change a little bit here and there. Your brain's, you know, plastic. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's debate about that, about what features change and which ones change more. And let's just assume we're not even talking about the situational differences, right? And, you know, like I know that like agreeableness, for example, is supposed to change in your 30s a little bit and, you know, things like that. People on average become a little bit more agreeable, you know, things like that. But really, pretty much, if there's any sort of personality traits that are basic, you know, there's a kind of stability to them. And, you know, personality traits, you know, those sort of traits aren't the only things to keep in mind. It's like, you know, certain basic dispositions to just hate certain sort of rule-driven, sanctimonious things or bullshit, yeah. You know, and that kind of stuff, I think, you know, it pretty much persists, right? At any rate, I mean, no one except for people in the church thought I'd changed fundamentally, right? None of them, you know, there wasn't a single person who noticed 1 ounce of change that I met who was, you know, no non-LDS friends thought there was any significant change. So,
yeah, that's actually a very good litmus test there. Well, we pretty much wrapped up.
Think like a stone, but the times they are changing.
Hi, this is Karen from the United Arab Emirates. That's in the Middle East. And I am a light set on a hill in the midst of my Muslim brothers and sisters. At least that's what they tell me at church. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Appreciate your participation, but I got to hear, in light of the success of our Little Factories podcast that my fellow brethren did recently, what is your take on Boyd K. Packer's sexuality?
Okay, so it's been floated out there that there was some sort of like maybe gay orientation that he suppressed and, you know, and the sort of horrible experience of that led to his weirdness about sex later, which did like cause me, along with Spencer Kimball's Miracle Forgiveness, a lot of suffering in my teenage years.
Yeah, because you're of the age where the pamphlet of the Little Factories was given to you as a slideshow, right? Am I correct?
Yeah, no, that's what I got in Teacher's Quorum. And of course, I'm sure that every single boy in there and every single, they didn't show this to the girls, but I know many of them would have felt awful too. You know, it's like, where have you put your appendages? What holes have you put them in, and, you know, if not that, what have you done to yourself? And it's awful, and it became the big focal point of everyone's spiritual life instead of, am I a good person? Am I cruel? Am I vain? Am I petty? It's like, am I beating off? You know, did I put my hands in her? Or, you know, do I have to confess to Bishop Stirner, who's dad's best friend, or something like that? You know, if I lie to him, but like confess to something less embarrassing, and I confess three things, you know, will that count? No, of course it won't. And then all the stress about that. Yeah, it was awful. But Boyd K. Packer, I think it's very possible that he doesn't have a gay orientation at all. He's got a normal heterosexual orientation, but he may well, in World War II, have had some sort of brushes with homosexuality. That's the sort of situation where it's very common in close quarters, and, you know, with this intense emotional experiences, you're with each other all the time, to feel like an intense attraction to someone who's same sex and not have the orientation at all at any sort of fundamental or persisting level, and to be traumatized by it. So a lot of the stories about it being okay to beat someone up if they come on to you may well be defenses against that. Of course, this is all pure speculation, but I think that you can do the World War II same-sex traumatic experience story without having to assume the gay sexual orientation that he suppressed and, you know, was asexual for the rest of his life, or, you know, something like that.
Right. And, you know, and we talked earlier today about, you know, cultures that normalized that intense feeling that you have for fellow soldiers, like the Spartans and the Athenians.
Yeah, no, I like when teaching classes on Plato, right? Yeah. You know, Socrates talking, you know, or all of them, you know, the Symposium by Plato is a speech, you know, series of speeches about love by famous Athenians, and it's almost all about boys, you know. And so, yeah, you study a little bit of philosophy, and you start learning about the possibility of something different from our ways of sexualizing, you know, socializing people into their sexual identities.
Right. So, in summary, you think it's probably the most likely scenario that in his exposure to intense camaraderie and close quarters and the feelings that you get for your fellow soldiers, that's, you know, non-homosexual, same-sex affection may have scared the shit out of him for the rest of his life.
Now, that's all on the assumption that there was some sort of same-sex attraction that he had. If you know, I think it's entirely possible that he's just kind of predisposed to bigotry, you know, and he's just someone who, if there's something wrong with the church and the culture thinks it's deviant and all that, that he's all for, you know, passionately being against it and beating up people if necessary, if they're trying to bring you into it. I mean, I don't think he had to have had a traumatic experience at all, but I'm saying that if you assume, if you think that there may have been some traumatizing same-sex attraction, he didn't have to have a persistent gay identity after that for that to have happened and traumatized him.
But it's possible that he brushed up against it in his...
Yeah, or he watched it in other people, you know, yeah, I'm sure.
That's what I mean by brushing up against it, like he saw
Yeah.
it. Yeah. Not that he brushes
Not his brushing himself up against it, yeah. Yeah. But I was relieved when Boyd K. Packer in the film strip said that wet dreams are okay. At least I wasn't guilty of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know that, you do know that because I've told you this story, but a stake president that I admired greatly in 1990 when I was 16 years old, in state conference, gave an impassioned talk that wet dreams are of the devil. So apparently... This stake president was not aware of the Little Factories pamphlet. So that's why I found the Little Factories talk when I first came across it after I left the church so confusing.
I would just love to have known what he thought you could have done to prevent it.
Yeah, no, I mean, and he's a medical doctor, for Christ's sake.
I mean, just seriously. I mean, the one way that I can think of that's a very efficient way to prevent it is to have sex a lot or masturbate a lot. So those aren't viable options. No, and so what an impossible.
If you listen to talk, that speeds up the factory. And then it just goes out of control and you're fucking animals.
Yeah. Well, I hope your whole audience right now is singing hymns to themselves as we talk so, like, openly about these things that are probably arousing bad thoughts. So
you've been listening to If and Stand Through.
If and Stand Through.
If and Stand Through.
If and Stand Through.
Say, please subscribe to us.
Please subscribe to us.
On iTunes.
And iTunes.
And give us feedback.
And give us feedback.
We like 5 stars.
We like 5 stars.
And go to Infants on Thrones.
And go to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.
Yes!
.com.
.com.
That's our website.
Please invite us, because this is me and Daddy speaking. Please listen to us. Goodbye.